Michael Harrington has tried to live his life in a way that's consistent with his political beliefs, and he hopes he hasn't been self-righteous about it. Harrington is frequently described as America's foremost socialist. His 1962 bestseller, The Other America, described the poverty that more prosperous Americans were largely unaware of at the time. After John F. Kennedy read the book, he proposed federal anti-poverty programs, which led to Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. Harrington now co-chairs the Democratic Socialists of America, which he describes as part of the liberal labor wing of the Democratic Party. He's also a professor of political science at Queens College and a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. Harrington has devoted his life to social change and sees himself as a long-distance runner, even though the finish line keeps receding. Now at the age of 60, Harrington's pace has been slowed by cancer. He's written an autobiography titled The Long Distance Runner. He opens by explaining how in 1949 he became a social worker for opportunistic reasons. He wanted a job so he could save money to eventually go to New York and be a poet and bohemian. But what he witnessed in his work changed his life.
It all began in St. Louis, Missouri, where I grew up. My family was deeply involved in the Democratic Party, and through political pull, I got a job at the St. Louis Board of Education as a social worker. As a matter of fact, I think this particular job was invented, particularly for me, because of political influence. And I took the job with no higher interest than simply saving up enough money, coming to New York, finding Greenwich Village, and settling down to the work of becoming a poet. And suddenly, I found myself on the a section of St. Louis down by the levee, down by the Mississippi River, working with the children of white Arkansas sharecroppers and encountering for the first time in my life face-to-face poverty. And there is one particular day which was sort of my Saul on the road to Damascus moment. On that day, it was a rainy day in the early fall. The houses in which the poor lived in this area were actually very beautiful houses. They had come from the old St. Louis. Some of them were French. They had French windows. They had courtyards. Only in the courtyard you would find outdoor johns and open faucets and mud and filthy children. And on this rainy day, I went into one of these houses, and suddenly the smell was so horrible that I was practically nauseated. It was the smell of dead rats, of stopped-up toilets, of cooking smells, of too much living, of too much poverty, of too many people jammed into a small space. And that oppressive smell sort of broke through my middle-class existence. Middle-class people don't have noses. And made poverty something to me existential, something so unmistakable.
It's interesting to me that you wanted to stay around and help to see what you could and help see what you could do about it, as opposed to fleeing the stench.
Well, what happened was, when I left that house, I literally said to myself, I must spend the rest of my life doing something about this.
Now, a lot of people go through a period in their life, especially when they're in their teens or in their 20s, where they say just that, I must go through life doing something about this. And then they get a few years older and they figure, well, I've put in my time, I've paid my dues, now it's time to think about me and my family. And they kind of drop out from that life of commitment to go about a more conventional middle-class life. That never exactly happened to you.
Well, that gets back to something that I try to explain a bit in my new book, The Long Distance Runner, which is that it seems to me that as far back as I can remember, that is to say, as far back as when I was 4 years old in kindergarten at St. Rose's School, and skipping lunch so I could give my lunch money to the nuns so I could help save a baby for Christ in China, that as far back as at the age of 4, I had a commitment somehow to act in the world, to change the world. And one of the things that I think about my life, which has now been since that day in St. Louis, well over 40 years of commitment, is that it's really no credit to me that I had to do it, that it was born in me, that it was something that I was, that it was almost a fate. It's hard to explain, And I don't want to say, by the way, that after that moment in St. Louis and that house down by the levee, I never turned back, because I came to New York, I hung around the village, I did my fair share of drinking, I had an enormous amount of fun. I did not become a solemn, puritanical struggler against injustice. But it is true that from that moment on, my life changed, and it shaped, I think, the rest of my life.
My guest is Michael Harrington, co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America and author of many books, including his new memoir, The Long Distance Runner. Now, that said, you've still gone through certain experiences that have tempered the way you've expressed your commitment to social change. For instance, you write in your new memoir that when you became a father, you discovered a certain willingness to be selfish and you lost some of your inhibitions about making money.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah.
Because one of the things, it is one thing to have a bohemian poverty, which I had for many years,
mm-hmm.
or for the 2 years that I lived at the Catholic Worker, a religiously based poverty. It's one thing to have that poverty for yourself. It's one thing for me as an individual to live in sort of rotten places and eat cheap food and skimp. But it's another thing when there are innocent little babies who did not ask for a life of poverty, who are your children, whom you love, whom you're responsible for. And I think that fatherhood, parenthood, may be one of the great bourgeoisifying experiences of all time. It certainly was for me.
So how did it change you? What specifically did you do differently in the ways you went about making a living and where you lived?
Well, it made the difference, number one, that when I first became somewhat successful at the age of 35, when the other America made quite an impact on this country, suddenly people began to ask me to speak and to pay me money for speaking. And strange as it may sound, I was terribly upset by suddenly making money. It was one of the most difficult experiences in my life because as a bohemian radical with practically no money, and I managed to have practically no money until I was 35 years of age, there were no ambiguities, there were no possible hypocrisies. But suddenly in the mid-60s, when people would pay me the unheard-of sum to me of $500 for giving a speech, I didn't know what to do. Once I became a father, I knew what to do. Ask for $750 and try to make more money.
So how old were you when you became a father?
I was 40 years of age, and that was a real shift, a psychic shift in my life. It eventually led me to the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
Your
wife says something very funny that you quote her as saying in the book. When you realize you wanted to move to the suburbs in part because the schools that your children were about to enter were very tough schools where they'd have to defend themselves in
right.
order to get an education. Your wife said to you, well, what is the appropriate suburb for America's foremost socialist to move to?
That's true.
An interesting question.
Well, as a matter of fact, she refused to look for a house in Scarsdale on the grounds that for my public image, having a Scarsdale address would be too much. So we went to Larchmont, but the New York Post attacked me anyway.
Where is Larchmont?
It's in Westchester. It's not too far from Scarsdale,
mm-hmm.
and it's a nice middle-class suburb. There's a few rich people there, but it's no more, no less than the middle class. I like it. I was in love with New York in the way that a 21-year-old from St. Louis falls in love with New York when I came in 1949. I left Manhattan and the village reluctantly and even bitterly, because I simply couldn't afford it because of the problem of schools and my kids, the problem of subways and my kids. But at the same time, even when I was at my most holy and pure at the Catholic Worker, living in voluntary poverty, eating just god-awful food, I always used to say to myself, I'm not against good food. I'm not against clean sheets. I'm not against good wine. They're terrific things. I'm against the way they're distributed. But I never got into that kind of perverse saintliness where you make a positive joy out of the fact that the food you're eating is no good. So that when I got to the suburbs, it was a contradiction. I still feel torn between my radical egalitarianism and the fact that I lead a middle-class life. But on the other hand, I happen to think that a nice house and squirrels in the trees and those kinds of things are not bad at all. They're quite good. What I would like to see is for everybody in the United States to, and everybody in the world, to have the chance to live that kind of a life.
Do you ever feel that you've judged some other middle-class people too harshly?
Not really. I must say that when, even when I was at my most radical and my most pure, both in theory and in practice, and had no money and all the rest, I always understood that you don't look down on the compromises that other people make. Life is a compromise. Everybody makes compromises. Nobody is really pure. I understood that at my purest. I also, by the way, understood, let's say, when I was at the Catholic Worker, 2 years of living with alcoholics under very difficult conditions. We were impure there, too. The Catholic Worker was, for example, a pacifist community. Yet we often had problems of violence. People from the Bowery are not always quiet. People coming off of terrible drunks sometimes get violent. There was one man in the house, Tom Sullivan, who was not a pacifist. And when the violence would break out, we would always call for Tom Sullivan. That is to say, we could not handle it in a completely Gandhian way. Nobody is perfect. So I'm for some reason, I had a certain spirit of charity, even at the time when I felt the least tension, the least hypocrisy. And thank God I didn't condemn the middle class as such, because I'm sure a member of it now.
Well, I think a lot of people, when they move to the suburbs, feel like, well, you know, if they've been liberal or leftist before, feel, well, now I have to revise my philosophy to bring it into step with the way I'm actually living. You've actually, I think, had a lot of radical friends who've become very conservative, who've really switched totally to the other end.
Yes, but that did not happen to them because they moved to the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, and it's one of the sad parts of my life history. Some of the people whom I knew when I was in my 20s, in the 1950s, who were radicals with me, we belonged to an organization which was the youth organization of a group on the Attorney General's list of subversive organizations. The FBI used to take a live interest in us. We were opposed to the Korean War. Our members were sometimes given discharges from the armed forces on less than honorable circumstances, simply for being members of ours, and so forth and so on. People whom I knew under those circumstances, who stood up against the FBI, who fought the majority current of the society relentlessly, later, primarily I think because of an obsessive anti-communism, came over and supported the war in Vietnam, in effect. And I was much too slow in breaking with some of those friends, I think, as I look back. And one of the reasons was I could not bring myself to believe that friends of mine who had stood up against the FBI on the issue of the Korean War had actually gone over to support the war in Vietnam. And yet, the thing I would emphasize is that I think that these people did this for very wrong reasons, in my opinion, but not for dishonorable reasons. They didn't do it for money. They didn't do it for power or prestige or houses in the suburbs. They did it because they believed in it. I think they were terribly wrong.
Yet you're sorry you didn't break with them sooner.
Yes.
Why?
Well, because I think, and if I have any fault to assign them, it's this, that they knew they had changed, and they didn't tell me. I think, though, that I was stupid in being so slow, so trusting, relying so much on those memories of our good old days and our radical youth, not to know that I should have broken with them earlier.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short break before we continue our conversation some more. My guest is Michael Harrington, who is co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America and the author of 14 books on social policy and political theory, including The Other America and The New American Poverty. His new book is a memoir titled The Long Distance Runner. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Michael Harrington is my guest, his new memoir titled The Long Distance Runner. Do you feel in the course of your political activism over the years that you've had to face the shattering of beliefs or of illusions over time, that you've been disappointed in certain countries or in certain people who had been models to you at one time and then went wrong, turned cynical, turned bad in some way?
Not in a strange way, my answer is no. And I'll tell you why it's strange. Take, for example, the triumph of the French socialists in 1981. When François Mitterrand was elected president and the socialists got a majority in the parliament and proceeded to enact their program into law. I had high hopes for that. I knew Mitterrand. I knew the French socialists. I had spent a fair amount of time in France. And I thought, finally, perhaps we're going to have a breakthrough where we socialists will demonstrate in practice that we can really run a modern society with justice and with efficiency and with growth. And they didn't. I was in France teaching at the University of Paris in 1983 at one of the worst periods of that socialist failure. So was I disappointed? Enormously, of course. Did it disillusion me? No. And the reason is that from the very first moment I became a socialist, long before I had ever read Antonio Gramsci, I had what you might call a Gramscian perspective. That is to say, I have always understood that socialism is something that is not going to be achieved in my lifetime or the lifetime of my children. Indeed, that socialism may be something that is never achieved. That socialism is something to be created. It's not a sure thing. It's not a historic guarantee. That if socialism does triumph long after I'm dead, it will do so after a terribly long process of defeats as well as victories. And therefore, my attitude has been almost from the very first that when I am disappointed in this or that socialist project or this or that socialist leader, it does not lead to disillusionment. Because in a sense, I have always expected that this is going to be a long, ambiguous, and difficult struggle. And I've never asked anything more than the right to participate in it.
You know, there's probably a lot of people in the United States who would be more comfortable with your egalitarian ideas if you didn't label them as socialism. Because socialism, to the minds of a lot of people in the United States, is the same thing as communism. And to a lot of people, they're both almost dirty words politically, dangerous words.
And no question about it. But why then do I stick to the word socialist?
Right.
Well, for a number of reasons. Number one, if I believe, as I do, that a radical restructuring of society is taking place, it's taking place right now, that the issue is not whether we are going to have radical change, in the next 10, 20, 30 years. That's settled. We are. The issue is whether that radical change is going to come from above, whether it's going to be authoritarian, elitist, whether it's going to be at the expense of the people of the third world abroad and the people of the third world within the United States, or whether it is possible for there to be an actual democratic bottom-up control of this enormous transition in human affairs that we are living through. Now, if I understand that as a basic proposition, and that's the in a sense, the political proposition that has animated my life, and I would say, I won't call this socialism. Number one, somebody else immediately will. They will say, you can't get away with that. That's socialism. And they would be right. And the people who have tried this, for example, some years ago, Tom Hayden had the Campaign for Economic Democracy in California. And many of the people regarded economic democracy as sort of a code word for the S word. We'll call it economic democracy. We won't call it socialism. But what happened is people would immediately say, but that's socialism. I remember talking to Tom Hayden, first time he ran for the state assembly. And I told him that Democratic Socialists of America were going to support him. He said, you better, I get called a socialist all the time. The point is that I believe America has to grow up. America is the only country, the only advanced industrial country in the world, which gets the vapors when you use the word socialism, which has this misunderstanding. And either we get over that, or else we will not simply be anti-socialist. We are anti-socialist. But because of this childish attitude towards socialism, we will have a less than decent liberalism. America is a society with a right and a center and no left. That's the fundamental problem. That has not to do with semantics. That has to do with historic political reality. I want to change it.
My guest is Michael Harrington, and he's written a memoir about his life in politics titled The Long Distance Runner. I want to ask you something else, another subject, a very personal one that you bring up in your new book, and that's cancer. And you're dealing with cancer now, cancer of the esophagus. And before that, you had cancer by your tongue.
Right.
So you've already been through a long series of radiation therapy and I think chemotherapy as well. You write in your book that when you realized you had cancer, you were thinking about the possibility of imminent death. And you decided, well, that was no reason to turn your back on atheism.
Right.
And I'd like to ask you a little bit about the kind of dialogue that went on in your own mind about whether this was going to be a time for you to become religious in a way that you hadn't been religious before, or whether you were just going to be the way you'd been and deal with illness with the same kind of ground rules that you lived your life.
Well, you see, as I mentioned in The Long Distance Runner, although I've been an atheist for 30 years or so, I consider myself a religious person. That is to say, the religious emotion is something that moves me. I grew up a Catholic. I still have enormous respect and even love for the church. My only problem with the church is I don't believe in it. And so religious thoughts are never that far away from me, although I must say that in the 30 years between leaving the church and getting cancer, I never had any particular desire to go back. But I love Gregorian chant. I read religious writings. I've written a book on religion and politics, so forth and so on. When I got cancer, when I began to look at an imminent death, obviously the question then raised itself, well, do you want to revise this? And I just saw no reason to. I mean, I'm afraid. I don't believe in Catholicism or any other religion, but certainly if I went back to religion, I assume it would be Catholicism I would go back to. I don't believe in it. And I felt that having lived my life believing that when I die, that's it. That's the end of Michael Harrington. There is no more. Oh, I will be remembered by my friends, and perhaps if my books survive for a while, I might be remembered by people who are not my friends in the future. But I feel that one has to face up to this reality. And indeed, a man who played a significant role in my life, the man who for six times was the presidential candidate of the Socialist Party, Norman Thomas. Thomas was an ordained Protestant minister. He was a Presbyterian minister. He, too, had broken with religion, not publicly, but in his own life and mine. And I used to visit Norman Thomas at the very end of his life when he was in a nursing home out in Long Island. And one of the things that I admired enormously about him was there he was blind in that last period of his life, waiting for death, anxiously hoping for death, but he was stoic about it. He understood death as something that was inevitable, death as something at that point that he welcomed. And he and I both, I suppose, but because we both came from religious backgrounds, would often talk about religious questions. But he did not make any move to go back. And that example perhaps was in my mind. As I told my cousin who was a nun, if I die and discover I'm wrong and there is a God, I'm not afraid of that God.
I want to quote something that you say in your book, and I really respected this. You said, you know, you'd been through, you know, dealing with cancer and all the treatments, all the terrible treatments you had to go through, And you came out of the first round and you said to yourself, what did I learn? Nothing but cliches. I really respected you for saying that because I think at this point we're really putting a lot of pressure on people who are ill or who have cancer to reach some kind of enlightenment because they're suffering and because they're facing the possibility of death, that we look to them for a certain wisdom and they're supposed to like be changed because of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. And I must say that when you're on a when you're on a cancer ward, when you're going through chemotherapy, actually, you're dealing with immediate things of the IVs in your arms, of the fact that somebody died two doors away. And I, in a sense, heard the last moments of that person because they were voluble. There is that reality, and there's really not much to say about it. There's someone, as a matter of fact, I won't use her name, a rather well-known woman. I find out lots of people tell me they've had cancer because I have cancer. They're sort of a club of us folks. And this woman surprised me by saying that she had had cancer, but she didn't tell anybody because she didn't think that there was anything anybody had particularly to learn from it. And she faced up to it, and that was that. And I think that's an admirable attitude.
But you've told people about it.
I told people about it because I had to, because I am the co-chair of Democratic Socialists of America. It's not just my life. There's an organization in which I am deeply involved. And I had to tell the organization because the organization had to deal with the fact that I was for a period of time not able to play the role I had. I'm playing more of a role again. I have no idea how much time I've got left. I'm apparently doing fairly well in my fight, but my existence remains, I must say, precarious.
Well, I want to wish you the best with your health, and I really thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your life and your politics. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Glad I could be here.
Michael Harrington's many books include The Other America. His recently published memoir, The Long Distance Runner, is published by Holt. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.